Welcome to the FinTech Scaling Show. This podcast is sponsored by Scale Up Consulting, helping FinTech startups create a scalable organization to support an ever-increasing demand. When you're ready to grow, reach out to us at richard@scaleupconsulting.co. Now, over to the show with Richard Doty, founder and host. Hello, FinTech leaders. Today in the show, we have Rory Ryan, CTO of Pippet Global. Prior to joining Pippet, Rory had a number of senior roles throughout sort of the FinTech ecosystem and also in other areas in and around scaling up businesses. So we're really excited to have Rory on the show today, really because of the fact we want to get into the detail as to how the technical side of scaling also works. So excited to have you on the show today, Rory. How are things going?
Yeah, great. No, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Cool. So let's kick it off. I mean, what I like to do at the start of the show is give a bit of a background to you and sort of your career and expertise, and also maybe start off with how that experience has helped you build out the infrastructure at Pippet.
Sure, go ahead.
If we look at your career and if we walk through it, what do you think are the main lessons that you've learned and things that you've taken out of every position that has helped you build out the infrastructure at Pippet?
Okay. Well, initially in my career, I started off as a software developer. So I learned cut my chops there. So I learned how to do whatever. And in those days, it was all C++, pretty low level stuff. And that was the way everything was done then. And when you tried to scale anything or tried to build big systems, basically you would just get a bigger computer. You just keep getting the next computer and then get a faster one. So my first programming job, we worked with Deck Alphas, which were new at the time. Alta Vista used to run on those, if you remember that.
Yeah.
That was their big proving ground to show how fast their Deck Alphas were and the Alpha chips were. And that was kind of the philosophy then was basically, if you need to do more, you just get a bigger machine. People hadn't really got to the stage of trying to connect machines together to scale them like that, or even hadn't really got to the kind of multi-processor side of things either. So it was all very much just more memory, more speed. So then after that, in other jobs, as computers got faster and they started to be networked together better, I had a period where I worked in telecoms, and telecoms, we used to have to process an awful lot of data. For a while, I worked in a company on something called performance management, which is basically to do with analyzing mobile networks to try and figure out where calls are being dropped and where money has been lost. If people can't make a phone call, the company's losing money. If the call is dropped, that gives the users a bad service, which means then the users leave. So to be able to do performance management, you need to be able to analyze all the data coming from all the different, basically, computers that run the mobile network all over the place. All the antennas that you see are all basically just big computers, and they would be sending back, they'd send back reams and reams of data that then had to be analyzed to figure out where the problems were. So again, even at that stage, we were using an Informix database that was massive, running on a massive machine. We actually wrote an actual shared object that connected to the database, so we could create our own data types for the database, so that then we could generate these metrics called Erlangs, which is a mobile phone way of figuring out of telling you how much data or how much throughput or how well the network is performing. So again, that was like a giant machine, but at this stage we were even like digging in even more, a lot more deeper into how the database works and actually just like building, like I said, just completely new data types that were then native to the database, and then you could run all the usual database operations on those data. So you had to implement basically all the different intersections and unions and plus and minus and the unity and everything. So that was a very interesting project as well.
You mentioned data processing. I was wondering, I mean, you know, we're in a world of data processing. How did that experience help you build out parts of the infrastructure at Pippet? Because I assume you're going to be processing lots and lots of data on a daily basis, right?
Well, not really so much in Pippet, because Pippet is more of it's an online transaction processing system. So
yeah.
It's more of lots of small messages, really. So we don't have the same the same problem. The problem you have with an online transaction processing system is that you need to make sure that the thing's up all the time, and it needs to be fast. So it's kind of a different, slightly different thing. The thing I mentioned before was to do with that we had to analyze the data, but you could take your time doing that as long as you got that made sense. And then it was to the analysis, so they could decide where to put in more antennas or what to do. But like I was, so then after that, the current, where I work now, Pivot Global, it's an online transaction processing system. So what we do is we allow people to basically get cash into the kind of the internet infrastructure. Mm. So if you have a credit card, you can use e-commerce, you can buy stuff with your credit card. Mm. And if you have a bank account, you can pay stuff with your bank account off.
Yeah.
But if you don't have a bank account, you don't have a credit card. It's very, very difficult for you to actually get money into the system. People say, like, well, why don't you use PayPal? But, like, how do you get money into PayPal? You use a credit card.
Yeah.
And what our system is basically doing is we're trying to provide a kind of cash transaction switch that allows people who have difficulties accessing the normal financial services because maybe they're migrants or they're just unbanked or who knows, maybe a poor credit history. And this allows them then to actually get cash into the general internet infrastructure. And then they can do all the stuff that everyone else can do. Because currently, if you're unbanked or if you don't have access to credit cards and stuff like that, you get massively overcharged. Do anything. So that's kind of the goal of the company does. From a technical point of view, then the kind of major problems are: number one, make sure the thing is up. So it's just a general high availability situation. And the other thing is make sure that it's fast, so that whenever transactions are going through, that they go through very quickly. Don't have to be super fast. It's not like high volume transaction processing when you're in a stock market, nothing like that. Yeah. But just things need to happen in a few seconds. That's all. Mm. And the other major problem is basically because what we do is we have to integrate with so many other systems. It's the problem there is how do you integrate with so many different APIs that all work a little bit differently. Every partner that you have uses different terms for the same thing. They have slightly different ways of doing things, and you have to basically. All that complexity needs to be built into our system so that we can present on our API all these other APIs as a single interface. So there's a lot of complexity there that we have to try and encapsulate and hide.
And you said three main things: make sure it's fast and integration. So if we take a look at each of those components, when you say make sure it's up, I mean, what does that mean? I mean, are we talking make sure it's up 24/7 so people can always access it at a point in time in the day when they want to access it?
Yeah, exactly. So there's a couple of different. To make sure. Yeah, because we're a global, it's pretty global. The global bit isn't just made up. We have partners in the Philippines, in Latin America, in Africa, Europe. So it really does actually need to be up all the time. So that means, so once you're doing that, then it'll give you problems with when you want to do upgrade software. It's like, how do you do that? So you need to do a kind of rolling upgrade. Or do you, so one way you can do it is you can do rolling upgrades across the world. What you do is you have multiple servers running. At the moment, we use AWS for pretty much everything. So we have auto-scaling groups. So what you do is you basically update the software on the auto-scaling group, and then it rolls through and restarts things on a rolling basis. And that's all like well and good. The problem you get is when you want to do something at the moment we run everything on a MySQL database cluster. So the problem then is if you want to change the database, so you need to add a new table, or worse, if you need to change a table or change a procedure, what happens then is you get some of them are using the old. Some of the instances of software are expecting to use the old database, and then you've upgraded it, and some of them they also need to be able to use the new database. So obviously it's easy enough to get the new ones, get the new instances to make sure that they know how to use the old database, how to use the new database, but it's more difficult for you to make sure that the old instances of the code will still function with the new one as they roll through. So that's kind of where you get to the problem of trying to get like 99.9999. Some of the sort of availability. So sometimes you have to basically just shut everything down and upgrade and bring it up again. But obviously you want to try and avoid doing that. That would be a very rare thing. But sometimes that does happen. I've seen in some other companies I've worked in, like kind of large companies. I used to work for Groupon, say, and I was head of platform there in Berlin. And that for the old, it was old City Deals, and then Groupon bought them. And they did all the transactions for all of EMEA, basically. So all the different languages, all the different currencies. And that system was similar, because that used to run on a whole thing used to run on a Postgres database, which was surrounded by caches. So, and there was layers upon layers of caches. So as long as you were reading from the thing went fine. But when you started to write to it, then of course there's only actually one database. And we ended up with a problem with that, in that we wanted to put on a replica, but the version of Postgres they were running was so old that they didn't even have the capability of running a replica. So we had to upgrade it to 9.4, I think it was, to get it to the stage where then we could turn on a replica, and then we could start trying to scale it horizontally as opposed to just always by surrounding it with caches. So that was an interesting lesson in how, like, in some ways, how not to do it, because Groupon, especially, was like, Pippin is an online transaction processing system, but we're slightly different. We pass around a lot of messages, but they're actually processing payments. They really had to be up. And so anytime the system went down, there was always an analysis to see how much money did we lose, because people weren't buying stuff. I think if there's a transaction, like a remittance, and it's delayed by a few minutes, as long as it goes through, eventually, like 5, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, that's okay. But if you do an e-commerce and people are clicking buy and it's not working, they probably never go back. So you've lost money. So there was always a big investigation into, you know, it took on a lot of import. The CEO would always know if the thing's down, because he'd be going, how much money did we lose? And if it was down for like half an hour, you could lose $20 million. So there was a lot of pressure to make sure that things did not go down. And because this is the way the system had built up over time, they kind of got to a stage where they were stuck. And it couldn't, nothing could be done. So there had to be, there was a, I think there was a one-year project when I was there to basically upgrade the database. Some night, shut the thing down for like 15 minutes and then bring the whole thing up again. And there was multiple live tests of that, simulation tests. We actually built a whole new network. They built a whole new network where we tested the whole thing. And then before we did it live, and thankfully when it did go through, it went through. But that was one. That was kind of an example of one way of doing things. So that just kind of builds up over time. And it was a very kind of big, the engineers were from Berlin. So they had a very much a focus on trying to use the machines that they had and to be efficient.
Yeah.
Whereas when Groupon in America bought CityDeals, they were in the States. They had a whole different philosophy over there. They had everything running on MySQL databases that did have replicas. And they just had replicas. So they had replicas of replicas of replicas. So in Berlin, they had something like 50 machines running the entire network with the same amount of traffic. And in America, they had 1,500 machines doing the same amount of transactions. So that's a completely different philosophy. And with the American way, obviously, they were spending way, way, way more money on everything. But it gave them a lot more flexibility. They didn't have the same problem. That they hadn't got themselves kind of stuck in a hole.
Okay. As we're talking about scaling up your tech stack, how have you guys approached this at Pippet Global as maybe a differentiator, for want of a better word? How have you looked at scaling up your tech stack so you continuously build on top of it rather than having to rebuild and rebuild?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, of course. Yeah. Well, it's kind of different parts of the system. There's a whole thing because we're like relatively, well, the idea isn't that new with Pippet Global, but the current, the latest iteration of it is new. And there's a lot more to it than just having the basic server. The server at the moment is a Java Spring Boost. So we just keep that updated. You get a lot of stuff. Don't let that fall too far behind the curve. You can just keep everything ticking along pretty well. Also, we use all the latest AWS tools like CloudFront and things like that, even though they're like a nightmare to get going. But once you do get it going, it gets you an awful lot that you can spin up a whole test environment with a click of a button. If we get a request from, for example, if we get a request from someone in East Asia who wants to do a white box Pippet, or they want to use us, but they need to be very fast, low latency, we can spin up a whole infrastructure with everything in it in Singapore or in Australia on the AWS network there with just a click of a few buttons. So by investing in the technology and getting the tools to work, which is a real pain, but it takes a hell of a long time because the documentation is not great, a lot of bugs in it. They're kind of working on it themselves, I think, at the time. But when you get it going, then it does pay off. So that's kind of more of you kind of get into DevOps kind of stuff then about whether, is that really technology or is it just configuration? Like, who can say? Like, is filling in a giant XML form, is that development? Who can say? But you have to kind of make a decision about whether to spend the time and invest in it, or whether you're happy to say, okay, we're going to build a new system, and everyone just starts clicking on the GUI to build it off, like from following a guide. That's the kind of thing we do. But I think it's worth it. I think for us, we decided to make the investment and to put a significant amount of resources into it to get those templates to work. And I think we reaped the benefit of quite immediately we got requests for somebody from a client that wanted a particular set. They wanted to have their own setup. And so they was having to stop and spend, 2 weeks getting it working. We were just click a button, they had it 5 minutes. So that's
And how long going that and doing that, sort of going along that road and going on that approach, I was wondering how long it sort of took to sort of get things moving from start to finish. So, making the decision, building up the team, and then obviously figuring out all the documentation and all the intricacies of building it out, and then obviously making it work. What is the timeline for that?
It takes 6 months.
Okay.
It takes one or two people. It takes at least one person 6 months, but that's an awful lot of work for one person.
Yeah.
But it takes, like, if you have a developer, you'd like to have two developers doing it. So at least if one of them wins the lotto, we said the other one is still around. Yeah. And then you need a QA to just make sure everything's actually working. Now, hopefully you've got test scripts that test everything, but it's still definitely going to click. It is possible to do, well, I say 6 months, it's possible to do as another task whilst someone is being a developer. So someone could be a developer working on stuff for like 2 or 3 days a week, and then they could spend a day or two working on getting the cloud templates going. Mm. Because you can ask, the best thing to do is if you can get a team to work in it, but there's an awful lot in it, so you kind of need to have a tech lead to go, I'll take this on as my responsibility.
Yeah.
Another person. And figure it out, and we will then educate the rest of the team about how to do it, and you can kind of slowly move your system into the cloud front way of doing things, so that you can start reaping benefits straight away. So maybe first thing you might do is you would test the auto scaling stuff, so then you could hopefully turn that on, so then you get that bit chugging along, so people don't need to be clicking that anymore. Hopefully then maybe you get templates for the alarms going, so then you can get the alarms into a system that they can figure themselves, that people get notified, so you can take it. So you can kind of do it piece by piece, but with two people kind of working on it a couple of days a week, it takes about 6 months to get it going. But then once you have it going, then you can just go, okay, instead of having six instances, I want 60, and then you just spin up. So that's really good. So there's a lot of you get a huge payback eventually.
How does it play back into your three problems that you're solving? So make sure the system's always up, fast transaction time, and also the integration. How does it all work into, how does it help solve those problems?
Well, the first one, obviously, you're able to do it. That's basically the whole point of it. The second one, what's the second one again?
Make sure it's in the system's fast.
As part of this, you build all your automated test tools, so you can run So then when you see something's getting slow, we're using a MySQL database, and that might not be probably the most modern way of doing things nowadays. Yeah. People would use, Elasticsearch or who knows what, MongoDB, lots of things. I stuck with MySQL, with SQL, because that's what I knew.
Yeah.
And also it has...
I used to do SQL back in the day.
I understand it completely. So I used to be a system admin one time, database admin, and it's atomic. So that you don't have to worry about things getting out of sync once you have it set up properly. And because I knew our system was going to be relatively small, the database anyway was going to be relatively small because the transactions are quite small, unless you're small, that it's actually possible. And the way I designed the database, because I knew how to do it, I designed it in such a way that any of the tables that were live, the actual live transaction tables, that they were small enough to fit in memory on the database. So didn't worry about disk reads. But once things were complete, then they went to disk. And it was also, they were being slow written to disk, so there was if the machine was turned off, if it broke down, we'd still have the information. But from the point of view of things actually being processed, it was all in memory, so everything was super fast. So there shouldn't be any, we haven't had any problems with any of our testing. We've ran tests of like 100 times our expected, our kind of best hope traffic. We can handle like 100 times that without any issues, so we're not worried about that. So our main thing was about, from the point of view of scaling, was to make sure the high availability is working and to enable us to test the database hard enough, because then you can put up 1,000 new things and actually see that the database fall over. So you have some confidence in that. And then you've got the high availability, the horizontal scaling for the high availability. So you know that the messages are always going to get through and they're always going to get answered quickly enough. You're not delaying anything. So that's kind of how it answers those first two.
And the integration, does it play a role at all in integration or not really?
Not really. Integration is there's a few different ways of, it's kind of the hardest problem really, is how do you integrate with all these different, there's a few different ways you can do it. You can try and set up a unified system and then create translation modules for every system that translates between that. And that's kind of the way we've done it.
Yeah.
So we build our perfect model, supposedly, and then we translate from all the other APIs into that via a translation interface. And that's the way we do it, which is fine, because then you just need to write that module. And also, it makes it, you can really compartmentalize the thing. So it's possible for you to, from the point of view of teams managing developers, you can assign different types. So when you analyze, when you get a new partner, you can analyze the API they have and see which class does it fit into. And then you can give it to people who are used to dealing with that side of things. So they can spin it up pretty quickly. Mm. It's also a lot easier to farm stuff out if you wanted to use like third-party developers, which we often do. Because that's how we scale as well, is that we have them from the point of view of like business scaling, development environment scaling, or how to scale the organization. Mm. Because sometimes we get a lot of requests for integrations at the same time, so then we need to scale it out to other developers. Mm. Sometimes the teams that we have, so we have internal team of developers, the senior engineers, and they know how everything works. Mm. And then we have external teams. And some of those external teams are able to scale as well. So we can ring them and say, we actually, you've got a huge amount of work coming in. We need, we reckon it's about 3 times as much. Are you able to scale the team up? Mm. So they would then be able to add more engineers to that team based around their experts that will be working on certain parts of our system. So we can get that to scale as well. And then there's also sometimes we might get, say, from the e-commerce side of things, we get a client that wants a particular e-commerce shop. Mm. WooCommerce or Spotify, who knows what, Shopify or whatever, there's thousands of them. They want to plug into our system and they don't want to have to do it. So we'll go, okay, so then we can actually farm that out to, we have external developers who know about PHP and know how all these shops work, so we can get them to do it. And then we can spin, once we get one, say like WooCommerce, that's based on, what's it based on again? OS Commerce, they're all a bit like kind of all based on OS Commerce from back in the day.
Yeah.
We can spin all them up pretty quickly, so we do that as well. So we kind of, that's the kind of a whole other way of scaling out the development.
And talking about your teams, I mean, how have you, outside of using third parties and also obviously building out your internal team, but how's your team transformed as you've built up? What does that look like? Is there specific people in SMEs focused on various different parts of the systems? Is it more agnostic, system agnostic? How's that team built up over time?
Sure. Well, yeah, it's like we kind of have, there's the core development team that looks after the core server.
Yeah.
And they would look at, and so that'd be the guys in-house who then also, they would be the kind of the principal engineers and the senior engineers that would manage another external team that we have in the Ukraine, where they have a number of developers, and they work on everything. So we do a whole, all the usual software, the modern software like lifecycle. And those guys, they are part of the team.
Yeah.
So every day we do stand up, everything's done with tickets, all the usual stuff, everything we do reviews. The developers have over there are able to organize themselves as well. Yeah. And they have QAs built in, all that sort of stuff. So that'd be one section of it, which would be the core QA core system. Then another part of the core system, of course, is that we have a very sophisticated dashboard to the system that allows you to see what's going on, allows our clients to see. There's a whole admin module where we can see everything that's going on. There's our clients have access to it as well, and they see everything that's going on with their particular accounts. Mm-hmm. They also have different types of users, so they can assign different properties to their own users inside their accounts. So some of their users can do things, some can't. And they can also configure an awful lot about their accounts. So this is part of scaling too, of course, in that we try and enable the clients to be able to configure as much as they can themselves by the backwards, so that they don't have to send tickets to our customer support department to get something changed.
Yeah.
Like a big part of that, for example, is because we do like a lot of his orders. So just to kind of describe the use case, like how do you pay? So you might be on, something we're working right at the moment is Pipit. It's a pair. We have a joint venture with a mobile expert mobile company. So we're going to have a lot of it called Payer. And that is going to be a mobile app that will allow you to pay your bills anywhere in the world with cash. So if you're a migrant living in the UK, say, and you want to hear this electricity bill back in Kenya, you'll be able to go into this app. You'll be able to select your country where you are. So you're in the UK. You'll be able to select, I want to pay a bill in Kenya. it'll come up what kind of bill you want to pay, your electricity, and then you'll get Nairobi Power and Light Company, select that, you put in the account number you got from the bill, and then you pay it, and then you can pay it. And what happens then is you, when you say, I want to pay this bill, we do a calculation on the FX and everything like that, and we present them with a proposal that if you go to the shop and you pay 50 or 60 pounds sterling, then we will ensure that 5,000 Kenyan shillings shows up in that utility's bank account. So that bill will be paid. And then we give them, if they say, yes, okay, I'm happy to do that, then we give them a barcode, and they get a location, they get a map of based upon where they are. Yeah. And then they can toddle down to their local shop, and they can present that barcode, is scanned, they hand over the money, and then all the messaging happens, and that bill gets paid. So that bill will be paid that day. So that's kind of one of our main use cases. So as part of that, as you can see, there's this order page that has the map and the instruction, and every country has different formulas. Because we got different partners in all the different countries.
Yeah.
And also all our clients, a lot of them want to, with this particular mobile app, this is us, so we can control it. But a lot of our clients, they want their order page to look a certain way. They want to have different emphasis on it. So what happens then is, what used to happen was, we get requests saying, can you make it look like this? You get an email, can you make it look like this? And we'd be like, okay. And then basically you end up having that either over to a graphic designer. The graphic designer makes it look a certain way, but it doesn't actually work properly. So then you need to hand it to a developer to make their graphic design work. And it's very costly and time consuming. So what we're moving towards, it's not quite there yet, but what we're moving towards is that we're making this, our system, that you can actually go on and you can configure the order page yourself. So you can go in and you can actually change the code until you get it to work and make it look the way you want. So we can put it back on the client. If they have the expertise, we can say, well, if you want to change the text, just go and log on to your dashboard, change the text. If you want to do something fancy, then it's kind of more of your problem. So you're gonna have to figure out how to do it. So here's a link to W3 and start reading. Or if they want us to do it, then we can charge them for it. There's no problem. Of course, it'll be that we just say that's it. This is a deeper integration that involves us doing work. So we're going to have to charge you. So it's up to them then how much you want to do. But by doing that, that's the way of scaling too, because it takes a huge amount of, it gives them a lot more control over what their orders look like. Sometimes when they see how much effort it is in doing something, they decide they don't really need it, which happens a lot. If you ever work with graphic designers, you know that that's often the case. Can you make the snow look warmer somehow, please? This kind of stuff. Yeah. So when they realize this, how much effort is in it, then they often go, actually, we're quite happy with that button being that big and there, as opposed to moving, rearranging it. So that helps you, because what you want to do when you're scaling is you want to avoid costs on your side.
Yeah.
You can have some clients, you can demand XYZ. You can spend 2 weeks doing stuff for them, and then it turns out that they actually don't do that many transactions anyway. So, because you never know, people will say, client will say whatever about how many. They're full of hope, obviously, that the system's going to go great guns. And sometimes it does, and sometimes it doesn't, but you don't know that. So we just try to make sure that if we are doing special work for them, that we're able to charge them for it. So that means then we can, if we need to scale out and hire developers or graphic designers, then we can afford to pay them.
Yeah.
And also make sure we cover our costs just managing it all, or else we can just make sure that we're not losing anything on the transaction, because it'll just kill you otherwise. Because if you're integrating hundreds and hundreds of clients, it really adds up.
And I mean, you touched on it. You gave a good example there around how do you sort of, I guess, minimize costs and also make certain that you don't. Make certain you charge, actually, make certain you charge for bespoke work. But what other critical maybe processes or systems have you put in place, or are you thinking about putting in place, other than the one we just chatted about, that will allow you, that will support your growth and then support your scaling?
Mm-hmm. Well, just from the point of view of, because we started very small, obviously, and then we got our seed funding and we got bigger. It's just simple things. There's things like stuff, like how do you manage your actual corporate network, for example? So you buy people machines, and then you install, and then most people want Windows, and then you've got designers and marketing people who want OS X. But you don't want to hire a system administrator because you're not big enough. And I didn't want to do it because I did it before. It can take up all your time. So it's like, how do we avoid that? But you still want your network, because we're a fintech company, we still have to be secure. So there was a lot of analysis, a lot of pondering and investigating, because it was because things have been moving on a lot with mobile device management and so on. And also even in Microsoft land, where a lot of the company wanted to be, they've moved on a lot. So we found that we were actually able to use a thing called Microsoft Intune to run the network, configure all the machines, configure all the users, without having to have a primary domain controller, without having to have a system admin, without having to have all this stuff. We basically spun up this thing. When we bought the machines, we figured out what the best machines were. We got all the same ones. We configured them and attached them to Intune. And then we were able to control them from Intune to whatever level we needed to. So we could see all the applications that were installed. We could uninstall applications if we needed to. We could ensure that the screen set, that the time screen machine lock was, we can ensure that passwords were good. And also if the machine was stolen, we could kill the machine and wipe it. So they were kind of the main things. So it took us a few weeks to get that going. It was a lot better than hiring a system admin. And I even looked around at hiring companies to do that for us, and it didn't really exist, not in Ireland anyway. There's some companies that said they could do it, but I didn't really feel that they could. And we sat down and we said, we'll just try this. We'll try it out for a few weeks and see if we can get this system going ourselves. And we did. Because this is not that difficult to manage now. It'll take up, it takes up minutes a day rather than like half a week.
That's what you want, right?
Yeah.
You want to be efficient. You want to be on the front foot all the time.
Yeah. So that's what, probably scaling. So within a couple of weeks, we managed to secure our network.
Yeah.
We could see everyone was logged on. All the applications. We could install a virus checker on everyone's machine if we wanted from our machine. We could do everything we needed to do. And that was done. So that's done. Next thing then you're thinking about is like, so the marketing and the business development people are like, well, how are we going to manage the system? So there's lots of different ways. Like in the IT side, we use like Jira for tickets, and it's all kind of fairly standard stuff from a developer point of view. But from a more business point of view, it's a lot more complicated. So eventually we became the IT and marketing and the business side. They settled on HubSpot, which is fairly pricey, but they found it very configurable. And they were able to set up their. We spent an awful lot of time in the company, like working out, getting all our documentation there and all our processes together. So they were able to configure hotspots that it could actually go through. So when we got a new client, there would be a certain checklist of things that have to be done, and people would have to do those. And when they were clicked, it would go on to the next stage. And there was much stuff to do. Then it would come down, and then next thing, the IT department would start to get tickets about. You need to have a meeting with their CTO, or you need to analyze their API, and then. We have to approve it, and there'd be approvals. Then it would go through this whole system of that. Initially, when it was quite large, and after about a year, we kind of reduced it down to a bare minimum of stuff. Because you don't, things not happening because you just wait for somebody to click a button. So we managed to get rid of all that. So that's kind of more of a process thing. But they found the HubSpot very, very good for that, and you can get really good reports about where things stuck. And then you could immediately figure out, okay, compliance is where things were getting stuck. So then we put a lot more resources into compliance. That's kind of one thing about working in fintech, I suppose. A lot of people, anyone who works in it, there's an awful lot of compliance stuff that needs to be done. There's an awful lot of proof, due diligence. You need to have an awful lot of processes put in place. You need to have documents that prove these processes are in place, that detail them in detail. And to get all that done, that takes a couple of years just to get that done. And then it's only when you have that done, you can actually really even sign up your first client, because before that, you're not able to, because you want their due diligence. So we did an awful lot of work on that, which isn't it's not IT stuff, but it's company business side of things, and it's vital for scaling. And then also, of course, once you've got your due diligence stuff ready, it's like, how then do you, different companies you went integrate with, sometimes they want you to do the same forms, but in their version. So then it's like, how do you do that? So it's like, we scale that as well. So we've got a gang of people in the Philippines, and what they do is if we get a new client and it's got all their own due diligence documents, and we give them our due diligence documents, and they just make it all fit. So we don't have people back in Galway or back in Ireland scratching their head, spending days on this as a team. And that's what they do all the time. So they know, and they do it for the company as well. So they know how to do it. So they make sure that we're able to pass. So our whole goal was to get from when we talk to a client, potential partner, to actually being live. How can we make that as short as possible, like a month, as opposed to years? So if they're on the ball, then we are always on the ball, and we can actually get this done. And we are able to get clients like live in a month now, from the first conversation with NDA signed, analysis of their APIs, they analyze our APIs, introductions, first use cases, sequence diagrams, all that kind of cooperation, then contract, get the contract signed, and then actually integrate the thing. So we can get that done in a month. depending on the complexity of what the integration is. So,
and that's a pretty lean process. And I mean, part and parcel of that is you guys have had to make certain decisions along the way in order to create such a robust process. And how have you gone about approaching your decisions as you've scaled and as you've grown?
Yeah. Well, and a lot of it is to do with the kind of I alluded to just a little bit ago, is that we have a meeting from a basic management point of view, we have a meeting every quarter where we analyze. We do basically a big retrospective on the company and go what went well and what didn't go well.
Yeah.
And we have data on how long it took to sign up clients and how long it took them to get through. A lot of that was, and once we had HubSpot and all that stuff, Jira, you could run reports and then the evidence is there of where things are getting stuck. So then it gives you a red light to where you should be focusing. And then we would dig in then and we'd go, okay, how can we modify the process to get rid of these roadblocks? Mm. So we would do that constantly. Every month we'd have a mini one. We'd have a mini retrospective where we talk about it for an hour and see where things are going wrong or where things are getting slow. And then we'd have a big one every quarter. And then we would change the process and reduce it. So I mean, I think in the HubSpot one time, at one stage, we had 20 steps to get from 20 different steps to get from the client from start to running live. Mm. I think we got it down to like 8 or 6.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. So,
but it's constant communication between you and the other execs in order to optimize that process and do it quickly, right?
Yeah, exactly. And just figure out like if someone's going, and also listen to the other members of the team, the employees, like the people who are doing. Like a project manager who's doing the due diligence, we say like, listen, I'm getting snowed under here. These are taking too long. Often it was because she'd be waiting for stuff to come back from other people or whatever. But we go like, okay, but what about this? They all have their own forms, and we're like, okay, well, how can we fix this? How do we get it that all you have to do is just direct other people? Let's scale out the people. There's some things you can fix with IT, and some things you just need to have people. And they were like, okay, well, how can we get a team it's kind of not the most interesting work, this filling in these due diligence forms, but you need to have people who are well educated to do it. So but it doesn't need to be done. There's no need for a huge amount of face-to-face interaction. So we talked about the companies, and we had a friend of ours sit on the next desk, and he had a gang in the Philippines who were doing some other stuff fitted in. And we were like, why don't we just talk to these guys about spinning that up? And then now we can do as many as we need, really. Then if they need to hire more people over there in the Philippines, then they can do it because they can train them up. So so now we have our project, our person who used to be able to do so many a week, now they can do tens.
Nice. You
know, tens a week. Probably more. So that was kind of, and that was a lot of, you had to figure out what the problem was, step back, because when you're in it and everyone's going, you know, it's crazy in there sometimes. Got to take a step back and go, okay, how can we fix this? How can we take the pressure off? Where's the pressure point? How can we take pressure off that person and spread it out? And that was one way. That was not an IT solution. That was just a pure business solution.
Mm. Yeah. Nice. So, and listen, as you guys are moving forward and you continue to grow, what factors are you considering and what questions are you asking yourselves to make certain you continue on your growth path?
Well, the main thing, we've got to the stage now where the capability of the company and the capability of the software is really good. So it used to be a thing that every time we got a new client, they'd want something different. That meant we had to do development to get it to work. Yeah. Everything was like, why can't people just do this? But everybody wants something special, and everything was doing more work. And maybe more software development, maybe a new business process, maybe a new type of contract, maybe a new type of business even. And now we kind of get to the stage where it seems like kind of nearly anyone who comes along with any kind of idea, we kind of go, we have that already. So an example of that would be, for example, it would be like in our business, because it's cash based, there's often a delay. So like we would be told immediately when someone's gone into the shop to pay for something. We get the message, and we can tell our clients that the money's in the system.
Yeah.
But the extra settlements can take quite a long time depending on what country and what part. Mm. So some clients, that's not acceptable. They want to be able to put the money. If it's e-commerce, say, it's not so bad because they're used to having the delay even for credit card payments. So that's part of their business model. But if you're trying to lodge money to people's bank accounts, like cash, even that one's not so bad. But the other things like remittance. So you know, the people can spend money straight away. They want the money to be there. Their mother needs money for a hospital bill. Mm. And today. So what we do then is with that type of client, we were like, okay, well, we can do that for you, but we can build a float system where you basically every day we have a certain float, and then every night you recharge it, and we use that during the day.
Yeah.
And we can charge you with that, but we have to build the entire float system to get that to work, like on our side. Mm. So when you're doing cash out, say, for example, you never want to create an order that's going to be allow someone to go to a shop in the country and take out money unless the money is already there. So our partner would want to have their money first before they'd even give out any money. So that's one float. Mm. Then our clients on our system, then we would also have a float to make sure that they have float to take charge of our before we transfer. So you end up then with like three levels of floats. And all the messaging that goes with that, and all the procedures that go into like making sure that checking the bank account to see has that actually money actually arrived in that bank account. And so that was a huge job. That took like a 3 month project for most of the developers to get all that working and get that right. But once you have it, then next thing you know, you talk to someone and they go, oh yeah, but like, what about we want the money to go in straight away? And we're like, we can do that. Mm. Like we can charge you for it, but we can do it for you, and we can turn it on next week. So that kind of stuff, that it's just our capability now is so great now after all the work that we've done. Mm. So you're asking about the future, it's kind of like making sure that if we are going to invest now in new things, make sure that before we were kind of chasing, like we were new and we were trying to chase all the business that we could everywhere. Mm. And now we've built enough infrastructure that we can actually, what we're trying to do now, sweat what we have, get the transactions going, more and more transactions going through that. And then get to profit, hopefully very soon. And then we can kind of take a breather and look a little bit more further down the road, a bit more strategically rather than tactically.
Yeah.
We can start picking out what we want to do. So like this mobile bill pay app, this is part of that. The way we've set that up is we're a joint venture, so we don't have to make a massive investment in it. Because we're combining forces with the other teams, the company's mobile expertise.
Yeah.
So that way, we're sweating stuff that's there that we haven't been able to. We had built this bill stack. We'd expected client. We with a client in mind, but the client disappeared.
Yeah.
And so we'd invested all this effort in it, and then we went looking for another one, and we didn't find one immediately. There's other companies who were doing similar, but we weren't seeing anyone coming up quick enough.
Yeah.
So we decided to do it ourselves, and then we did the joint venture. So that's kind of like. That then, of course, reduces your capacity to do other things. So you have to be careful about what you do. So it's kind of, we've kind of got a stage, like I said, where transactions are building up. Hopefully we'll get to profit, we'll get into where all our graphs are going in the right way.
Yeah.
Going up and to the right. And we can take a breath and look a bit more strategic in it. So that's kind of like, that's where we hope to be in the next 6 months.
Awesome. And as most sort of fintech leaders like to do, they like to gain knowledge and always update skills and what have you. And a good way of doing that is either podcasts, listen to podcasts or reading a book. So you know, I'd like to ask you, do you have any podcasts or any books that you've read previously or reading now that you think our listeners should either listen to or go off and buy and read?
Well, at the moment, kind of, I listen to more... I don't have a huge, I've got twin boys who are like 2.5, so I don't have a huge amount of time.
So, okay. But that's good, though.
So that gets you pretty busy. So I listen more to the general science-based podcast.
Yeah.
Shortwave on NPR is very good, because that gives you a nice rounding and all the kind of new things that are going on.
And
I listen to the one that's based in California, KCRW.
Yeah.
Which is... So, like, various companies I worked with before, I was over and back to San Francisco and Silicon Valley all the time.
Yep.
So I kind of know that place nearly as well as I know Berlin or as I know Dublin. So I listened to that there, and their whole kind of ecosystem of that area of California is all tech stuff.
Yeah,
so you kind of get you gather it just kind of just by listening to general radio. Like you're talking about cooking and it's tech cooking. So I kind of keep an eye with things like that. I like for entertainment kind of podcasts. I watch like PBS Spacetime, which is a really, really good one. Have you ever seen that?
Nice.
And that often gives you kind of sends you off into places like NPR has their science podcast as well. I forget what it's called, Shockwave or something like that. And then for fun, for like just from the point of view of reading, at the moment I'm reading First Man, Neil Armstrong's book, which is
nice.
Which is a nice book. I just saw the film the other day actually, and the film is a lot darker than the book. But the book is really, really good. And then for kind of like more IT stuff, at the moment I'm reading Metasploit. It's actually kind of the guide to how to use the Metasploit 2 by David Kennedy.
Yeah.
And that actually really, really digs in, because one thing I didn't mention about all the things you need to worry about is security.
And
I used to work in a company before. I was the solutions. I was the architect in a crowd called Dimension. They're Heat Software now.
Yeah.
And they developed a security. We developed security software using the part I worked on was a thing called application protection, where we basically wrote drivers and they went for the Windows system that sat underneath, and they monitored everything the applications did, and then blocked it, and it was whitelists and blacklists and all that sort of stuff. And I was working there for about 4 years, and we learned an awful lot about security and how exploits and Metasploit, the tool itself. If you ever use the tool itself, you can really see when you hear in the news about the HSC got hacked in Ireland and nobody can have an operation now for who knows how long, and what they're trying to do about that. Yeah. Or same thing with the oil pipeline in the US, they got hacked as well. And when you get this tool Metasploit and you just try it out, it's amazing how easy it is to break into things. So I'm actually doing a bit of practice messing around with that. Reading that book. And so from a technical point of view, that's kind of where, like, that's where, as a kind of an executive, you kind of have your hierarchy of fears. So the first thing is like, will you get the thing to work at all? The thing is like, will it keep working or will it fall over? You know, like, and then as you go down, you kind of get to like, okay, and how do you make sure that somebody doesn't break in? And
yeah.
So I'm at the, I'm quite happy the thing works. I'm happy that it works nearly all the time. I'm happy that the employees and everyone, the business is working well.
Yeah.
And now I'm freaking out about security and like how to make sure that doesn't fall over. So that's kind of the dark. That's where I am.
Cool. Sounds like good reads. And listen, mate, really awesome to have you on the show today. I thoroughly enjoyed our discussion and sort of went a bit deep into some of the technical stuff there. So you really enjoyed it. And yeah, again, awesome show. And thanks for coming on.
Great. Thank you.
One last thing before we log off, how can everyone get in touch with you and the guys at Pipit Global?
Oh, okay. Well, if you go to pipit.global, put that into your browser, then that you'll be there. We have a LinkedIn page with all our latest news and posts. There's a Facebook page too. I think LinkedIn one is they're actually both used. We've had loads of announcements lately. We just finished the crowdfunding. We're not quite finished actually. It's still open, so you can still invest. But we've achieved our target and we're over it now. I think we're at 112% last I looked. So that's going to keep us trucking for quite a while. And yeah, we've done deals of, like I said, we've signed up all of Latin America. We can cash in all of Latin America. We can do mobile payments in Africa. We've got most of the rest in Europe. We hope to sign up most of all of Eastern Europe. We've got partners in the Philippines. It's all in Canada. So it's all going great guns, really. So we're connecting everything together.
Awesome. Okay. Well, thanks again. And looking forward to watching and checking you guys out. And good luck on off the back of all the upfront investment that you got recently. That'll be good.
Yeah. Great.
Okay. Awesome, mate.
Talk to you. Bye-bye.